A lonely, aging assassin spends his days reflecting back on a difficult life and the burden of his choices. Among those choices, killing Adolf Hitler and the Bigfoot. That's a far too brief description of a fascinating and earnestly idiosyncratic film starring Sam Elliott, which will receive its U.S. premiere in El Paso next week. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. Today, we'll have a conversation with writer-director Bob Kraskowski about his feature film debut, The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then the Bigfoot. The film will have its U.S. debut on Friday, August 10th at the Plaza Classic Film Festival, and Kraskowski will be joined on stage at the Plaza Theater by veteran actor and star of the film, Sam Elliott. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Charles. How are you?
I am great. It's good to hear your voice, my friend. I should mention you're joining us by phone from your home in Turner's Falls, Massachusetts, but by next Friday, you'll be in El Paso along with your star, Sam Elliott, for the screening and U.S. debut of your film Friday, August 10th. Congratulations on getting this wrapped up and bringing it to El Paso.
Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to being there.
I have to say, it's been a couple years I've known you, and I remember when I first heard about this project, The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then the Bigfoot, you had me at the title. It's a million-dollar title, and it spun out all sorts of ideas in my head of what that could possibly be as a movie. But if you could give us a brief breakdown of the film, set the listeners up for what's coming next Friday to the big screen.
Yeah, the story is about American war veteran named Calvin Barr, and he has these two large events that took place in his life, the killing of Hitler, and then as a much older man, the killing of Bigfoot. And between them is all of the moments in his life that he exchanged in the service of others. And so it's a exploration of these two big events and then how they were affected by the smaller moments in his life and choices that he made that led him in a different direction, that now that he's in his 70s is looking back and trying to find a way to reconnect with either family or humanity or whatever it might be. He's looking back and trying to reconnect with some things that he's lost. And just as he's trying to do that, he's being visited by the United States and Canadian government to kill the Bigfoot, which is obviously very disruptive if you're trying to figure yourself out in your twilight years.
This is a film that jumps back and forth across decades from the U.S. to Europe. It's got a lot of historical detail. Sam Elliott plays the older version of this lead character, and Aidan Turner plays his younger version from back in the 40s and 50s that we see in flashbacks. It seems like Sam Elliott was just the perfect casting for this lead character who's clearly shouldering some serious burdens when we first meet him, and it slowly revealed, unwound over the course of the film, just what some of those burdens are that he's carrying, and he's got to perform without much words. But it's so clear in just his mannerisms and how he moves that he's got this weight on him. Was he your first choice? I mean, it just seems perfect for this role.
Yeah, we spent quite a bit of time talking about who this might be. And it was difficult to choose somebody to play this role because we needed somebody that would embody this character and have this kind of Norman Rockwell look about him. Mm-hmm. And someone that would take it seriously and would make you believe this far-fetched story that we're trying to tell. And when Sam's name came up, I think we all got excited and hoped that he might look at it. And our casting director, Kelly Roy, got the script to his reps. And Sam read it. And on Thanksgiving of, I think it was 2016, he called me. And there's Sam Elliott on the phone, basically explaining why he wanted to do this movie and that it really meant something to him, and it said something about his father and the type of man that he wanted to be, and also just the state of the country right now. He wanted to, you know, Sam wanted to comment on that as well. And so there was a lot there that I think was speaking to him. And then
he basically called you and pitched you why he should play the part?
Not quite. And it was more, you know, we reached out to him and tried to, you know, we tried to get Sam interested in the movie. And when he called me, it was just a really nice open conversation about why we both wanted to work with each other. And that just continued all the way through production. So, you know, Sam is a very, very open, honest person. He takes his work very seriously, and he comes at it from a very emotional place. And I tried to match him at that every day and tried to, you know, really listen to his perspective, because the movie has this strange sort of magical realism to it. And
right.
Sam, you know, he was always looking for the realism. How can we make this more real? And so those were some of the most interesting and fun discussions. We're taking this completely ludicrous idea and every day making it a little more real. And I think the crew responded to that, seeing that we were both trying really hard to do something that could feel serious, even though it has these wild ideas in it. I think that that kind of filtered through everybody, and everybody's work shifted around that. So that's really a major credit to Sam.
Yeah, he's an iconic screen presence, and he certainly grounds the film as this man of action and man of few words. And as you say, it makes something that's doesn't seem like it would feel real, very real. And I was struck the first time I saw an early cut of this film, just how you were able to navigate all that without it ever veering or falling into camp or just a send up of a genre mashup. It's really extraordinary. And as a first time writer and director for a feature film, I just can't imagine how much more incredibly ambitious a project you could have chosen to try to pull off. I mean, did you ever have reservations developing this project that you were swinging too far?
I worried every single day. I still worry. I mean, the movie's out there in the world, and I still think about it. It was a really, really big swing for the fences for me and for a lot of this crew. We were all trying to do something that I think scared us a little bit because it was so unusual. And I paid for this concept with a lot of anxiety. And the only thing that really saved it for me and helped me to remain calm and to make the thing with a certain amount of excitement and joy was really that the crew that came together was just so, so special. And whenever I felt like maybe I wasn't on steady ground or I didn't know what I was doing, I could look to them and I would see how they weren't panicking and I could see how amazing they were at their jobs. And And that would calm me down and put me back in a place where I could get excited about what we were doing every day. But it was extremely complex, and it was a very difficult movie to pull off in the short amount of time that we were trying to do it and on the budget we were trying to do it for. It was all a big, I think we just barely snuck it through every day.
Well, maybe it felt that way, but you also look at the amazing collaborators you're able to pull in, you know, not just Sam Elliott responding to your script and believing in it, but John Sayles is an executive producer on this, the great writer-director, Douglas Trumbull, who's known for his visual effects in 2001, Blade Runner and Close Encounters. Somehow Joe Kramer comes on as a composer who's just worked on Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation. You got Skywalker Sound excited about this and offered up their editing and mixing bays up there and outside of San Francisco. I mean, each step of the way as the script made its rounds around and you told the story of what this film could be, clearly people were responding. That must have encouraged you.
It really did. I mean, there were a lot of no's. When we were making this movie, there'd usually be about 20 no's in a row. And then there'd be one phenomenal yes from somebody that usually was a hero of mine. And I don't know exactly how that worked, but I just know we were really fortunate. And it's hard to fathom it even for me. I think back on it and I try to connect all the dots. How did this all happen? I think it's just, at the end of the day, a bunch of people that wanted to try something challenging, and we all believed in each other. And we all knew that we were going to put in our maximum effort and that nobody was going to slouch on any given day. So there was a real intention to do this thing correctly. And I think we all inspired each other. But like you said, when I look around at this group of people, John Sayles and Richard Jurasich and Doug Trumbull and Lucky McKee and Sam and Joe, all these people, it goes on through every single department. There's somebody that I would have dreamed to have worked with 5 years ago. For them to come together for this is really special, and I really can't thank them enough. I don't even know how.
Well, there's an amazing El Paso connection here. This film was basically completed, post-produced here in El Paso with an amazing team of El Pasoans. Lucky McKee, you just mentioned, is a producer on the film. Andrew Semetic, who's sort of making El Paso his home base now as a sound designer and sound editor, and and our very own Zach Passero, who edited this film. And I know you guys worked together, and you basically decamped from Massachusetts down here for months and holed up with these guys and crafted every second of it day in and day out.
Yeah, Zach was about to have, him and his wife were about to have a baby.
And, I remember.
I had just finished the shoot in Massachusetts, and I couldn't imagine not editing this film with Zach and getting to spend time with Andrew Smadek and Lucky and be away from home. It was all, you know, very, very different and new to me, but El Paso is just a wonderful, wonderful place to work. It's very, very different than being in Massachusetts, so it was able to put me in a fresh headspace. Mm.
I was wondering that. I know it must have been difficult personally to be away from home that long, but creatively being, you know, holed up somewhere and just focusing on this thing in front of you must have been helpful too.
Yeah, no, it made it a very singular focus. And we were making this movie every day through production, through post-production with rockets on our shoes. So we had to focus. And so being in El Paso and away from my friends and my family, I only had one task I could focus on every day, and that was making this movie. And Zach is a tireless storyteller and editor and craftsman. And so whatever challenges came on any given day, we just did the diligence to figure them out. We shot a little more than 90 hours of footage, so Zach had a massive amount of work before I even got to town, just trying to hone the footage down to something that we could work with.
I was fortunate enough to see some of that process and get to pop my head in here and there. And one of the things that really impressed me about you, and I don't want to embarrass you, but when you watch a lot of first-time features by writer-directors, oftentimes they struggle with honing their story down in post-production because they've fallen in love with their characters, their writing, their script, and they don't want to let go of anything. And it was fascinating to watch you day by day chip away and tighten and give up some things that clearly meant a lot to you, but you knew that they weren't in service ultimately of the story and the finished film. That was really a testament, I thought, watching you work with Zach and Andrew as you crafted the sound and the vision for this film. And I don't know if that's something that was hard for you or something that you had gotten advice that you had to do, but it happened, and I think it made a better film.
Well, Zach is a persuasive storyteller and editor, and so I think, of course, at first, the notion of cutting some of these things out that you love is difficult, but every week that went by, it felt more natural, it felt more easy. Lucky and I had a lot of discussions about the edit. He watched every single edit of the film, and he would give notes, and they were extremely helpful notes. And then John Sayles wanted me to wait until I had a cut that I was really proud of, and I think that was the third or fourth out of six cuts.
Right.
And I sent that to John Sayles, and then he sent his notes along. And it just became apparent that I needed to trust the people around me, that they had great ideas and a lifetime of experience. And so I just leaned into that and trusted it. And, you know, I look at the film now, and there's a couple risks in the movie that we left in that are not typical of a movie that you're absolutely just trying to get to the finish line and you're pushing the story along as quickly as it can. This movie pauses a couple times and asks for the audience's patience, and I hope that their patience is rewarded because of what the people are saying and because of how it connects to everything else. But if there's something like that left in the movie, it was a team decision. We all spent the time and energy to make sure that we really wanted to leave that thing in and that it connected from one moment to the next in an elegant way so that it wouldn't just feel like these kind of jarring flashbacks. We tried to make it a little more seamless. And early on in the process, John Sayles, I had never read Slaughterhouse-Five, the Kurt Vonnegut novel. So I read it this summer after I finished everything. He always wanted me to kind of understand how this and that had certain echoes between them, and I can see that now, this notion that Billy Pilgrim is unstuck from time, and Barr is very much in that way too, where he's sliding in and out of his memories in a very organic way. And you know, that's something chasing that in an edit could be very jarring for the audience. And I just think that Zach's sensibilities as an editor made it a lot more comfortable for me to make those choices. But everything was discussed and kind of shared as a team, and that's how we came to the 98-minute cut that we have, cut down from 90-something hours.
Well, it's certainly a film that rewards an attentive audience, and I think it also, to your credit and the whole team's credit, I think it's a film that respects an audience's intelligence. It has a very deliberate pace to it and a very classical unwinding of the story in many ways, which is not how we're force-fed a lot of stories in cinema today. I mentioned in my intro that I found this a very earnest and idiosyncratic film. And, you know, I feel like it really appeals to the part of me that grew up on adventure classics and maybe early Spielberg. And it has a pacing that feels classically inspired. Was there particular films that were touchstones for you as you were developing the script and then conceiving the film? You did all the storyboards yourself, so you obviously not only had a story and dialogue that you constructed, but you had a very specific visual that you were going for and knew going in.
There were a few movies that had a big influence on this. Hal Ashby's Being There was definitely one of them. Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation was another one, this singular focused central character that's obsessed with his loneliness and his isolation, and also is incredibly good at the thing he does. And the thing he does is kind of also his curse.
Right.
I think that those things resonated with me. A lot of Frank Capra movies. You mentioned Spielberg, who I love, and Robert Altman movies. They all blended together in a strange way to make this movie. And then from literary sources that I found inspiring was John Steinbeck, Charles Dickens, Washington Irving. I was trying to make a parable or an American mythic in the storytelling, and then somehow find a way to draw in these really pulpy elements that wouldn't belong in a John Steinbeck book at all. But if he were to try something like that, I wondered what that might look like. And I think that was really one of the earliest elements of the writing was this attempt at trying a story about America and Americans and who we are and why we do the things we do, and then just put these two completely bizarre elements in there because I felt like not only would that grab your attention, but also that gives you a lot to work with. It makes the scope so much bigger. And John Sayles, early on in talking about this movie, said that science fiction has always kind of been a Trojan horse for deeper ideas. And we could use that to our advantage. I mean, there are episodes of The Twilight Zone that really have something to say about who we are and why we do the things we do. And you can enjoy it on the level that it has a great twist or that it's creepy or that it's unusual. And then on another layer, you can enjoy it because it has something very sly to say. And so I think that all of those things that I just kind of tried to mention there all tied together into this really, this strange mass of a movie.
Well, I know it was a long gestation and evolution, and you really sat with this story a long time, and I think it pays off. The film has a real patina to it. It has so many layers. Each time I see it, I see more deeply into it, and that's really a credit to you and your collaborators on crafting what is a short film that feels much longer and much more full than its 97 or 98 minutes running time. I remember, Bob, several years ago when I first met you and I began to hear about this project, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, you shared an earlier script and storyboards for the film with me, and my first reaction, I have to be honest, was be fascinated and have my mind spinning out at all sorts of possibilities that a title like The Man Who Killed Hitler and then The Bigfoot would imply. But my second reaction was that there was no way that you could pull off such a feat, that combining a World War II Hitler assassination plot with a Bigfoot storyline while trying to tell this you know, very down-to-earth tale of an aging man taking stock of his life. You know, it just seemed like a bridge too far, and somehow you pulled it off. It's really a fantastic film, and I'm just so thankful that you're bringing this film back to El Paso, where it completed its journey, and it feels like it's a great way to enter the world now. This will be the U.S. premiere, correct?
Yeah. Yep. We spent some serious time trying to figure out where we wanted to premiere this, and there was a lot of excitement from the Plaza Film Festival and from the programmers there, and ultimately Sam really wanted to come back to El Paso. He has family here, and I, you know, worked for months on post on this film with the team, and it just felt like we were supposed to come back. It just felt like the place that we needed to go. So I'm so happy we're coming to El Paso with this film. I'm happy that people are going to get an opportunity to hear from Sam and meet him and talk about this film. That's pretty special to all of us.
Well, it will be a special night, and I look forward to seeing you on the stage of the Plaza Theater next Friday. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you, Charles.
My guest today has been Bob Kraskowski, writer and director of the new film, The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then the Bigfoot, which will have its U.S. theatrical debut in El Paso at the Plaza Classic Film Festival next Friday, August 10th. Kraskowski and the film star Sam Elliott will present the film and discuss its making at the Plaza Theater, and tickets are on sale now for the screening through the Plaza Theater box office and Ticketmaster. More of my conversation with Bob Kraskowski can be found in the On Film archive on this station's website at ktep.org. On Film's producer is Lauren Tarazas. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.